Welcome to Helpful Social Work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so that people who need social work get help that will transform their lives. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jo. And this is podcast 5A from series 3 already. That's impressive, I think. Last podcast, we discussed decision making, some of the evidence around this, so we can be more self-aware about our judgments. We didn't have any podcasts in August. We were taking a break. So we encouraged people to download previous episodes. And we actually have a little bit of a top 10 going here, Jerry. Currently, the most popular episodes ever are Series 3, 2A, Building a Relationship. I think that's a good sign. Series 2, 7A, Diversity and Exclusion, Using Evidence, Trust in Social Work, and Social Work Regulation. Now, they all had over 500 downloads. Which I think is really good.
I'm particularly excited about social work regulation being listened to. If we manage to make that listen-to-able, then that's good.
Interesting topic. That is good, isn't it? And then series one, and this is my favourite. Series one, 1A, about integrity, it's got the highest number of downloads across all the series. And I think that's great because integrity is just absolutely the rock candy of social work world, so that's good news. Now, there are some guys that we could do with you giving a bit of love to, a little bit of listening to series one on evaluation, social control and trust. They could all do with a listen. They're a little bit neglected at only under, they've got under 200 downloads. So there we
poor
go.
Little things.
Yeah, I know. They're a bit left to the side. So hopefully we'll get some people listening to them. And thank you to some people who did some retweets of our last one, Helen Sowden and Katie Patrick, Liz Howard, Stuart Thompson and Simon Carvin, I hope. I've got to tell you, Simon, my pronunciation is never as good as I would hope it would be. And we have a few people visiting our Helpful Social Work podcast Facebook page, which I think is really exciting, and they're liking it. So thanks to Susan Bishop, Tracy Ann, Reshna Nepal, Christopher Durkin, and Donna Ray. And we really hope you are enjoying the podcasts. We're certainly enjoying doing them. So let us know what you think by visiting our website, www.helpfulsocialwork.com, or by commenting on iTunes. What are we doing today, Jerry?
We are going to talk about planning, which suits my little analytical self down to the ground. It's part of our exploration of the social work journey, which we started off a few months back with first contact, and we're going to be working through to the point when we end our encounters with someone. And can't really talk about the social work journey without talking about planning. We've put it here because we've already talked about relationships and assessment, and following assessment is kind of when you talk about planning. In policy and in process. In practice, of course, you're planning the whole time.
Planning is really about keeping your eye on the life journey people make. You know, you're really acknowledging that life is messy and changeable. People continue to grow and develop over their whole lifespan. And so from the minute you're encountering somebody, you're planning for change, aren't you, and development and difference, because that's going to come anyway.
And actually, that's really interesting because it fits with the definition of a plan, which is a proposed or intended course of action, which is not the same as what actually happened. And it comes from the same root as the plan, you know, in terms of a map that we have, and also the same root as we use for the word plant. So something that's kind of in the ground, something that's grounded and something that's a map. But yeah, you don't quite know how it's going to turn out.
And I think that's, I often think of social work as like, I think of us as journeymen, map makers and journeymen, you know, people who are actually helping people make choices about the routes that they're going to take on their life. And I think you're right. We don't know what encounters will happen along the way there. And I guess when we think about that journey, then we're thinking about planning and partnership, really, aren't we? That's the first thing to talk about, is the idea that to plan properly, we need to involve everybody who is part of that plan and not just kind of do it to somebody. And there's a really interesting piece of work by Nesta, and they're one of the partners in the What Works Centre being developed by Children's Social Work. And their piece of work is entitled Good and Bad Help. How How to Use Purpose and Confidence to Transform Lives. In 2018 it was done. And it talks about the experience of a man who has been homeless on and off for 12 years. And what he said of bad help really struck me. He said, people always tried to rush me, telling me what I've got to do, telling me I've got to do it. But I like to work it out for myself.
Yeah, and I think if you don't plan with the person, not only are you likely to, for it not to work, it's not like it's not as likely to work if they're not if you're not doing it in a way, if you're not working in a way that's going to be helpful to them towards goals that are important to them. But also you can actually disempower people more, can't you, by imposing a set of actions on them that they haven't really signed up to. And that idea of contract in social work is quite an interesting one, because I know that in children's services you sometimes would do a contract with a parent. But generally in a contract, for it to be really valid and really ethical, there needs to be free choice to come into it. And yes, we're always in a difficult position of potentially being able to coerce people. So you want the plan to be ideally as much that person's as possible, so that it is there isn't any feeling of imposing a contract.
And that can be really tricky, can't it? Because as a professional, we come into people's lives with an agenda, actually. And yes, we want to be helpful, but we also have a pretty well-defined view based on research and experience of what helpful looks like. And we also have some real limits to the amount of time we're able to offer people and what kind of resources we have to contribute with. And I think that all of that comes together sometimes to push us into a place that looks like telling someone what to do and how to do it without giving them any time to catch up and process what that would look like in their day-to-day life.
And I think the thing you just said about research or evidence is really, really important, because wanting to be helpful isn't enough. We need to know how to do that, and agreeing a shared goal and wanting to achieve it and trying to do that isn't enough. We need to have the best chance of actually achieving it. And the way to I guess work with someone and pull them towards a goal, rather than pushing them, coercing them towards a goal, is to lay out the evidence of what that might look like and why doing particular things might help you get there. So the research and the evidence, the experience of other people who've been on that particular path is going to be really important if you're taking someone on a journey, to be able to say, well, look, other people have tried that and this is how they found it.
I think one of the most helpful things to me that's happened over the last few years in terms of language and thinking about planning in partnership has been the concept of families as experts by experience and service users as experts by experience. I found that language really helpful, because what it's done is it's shared the knowledge and the responsibility with the worker and the family. Does that make sense? Like, you don't feel like you're the font of all knowledge coming in and having to do everything. You're actually acknowledging these people are experts in their own lives.
I think that fits really well with the emphasis on outcomes-based planning or outcomes-focused work. From an adult services point of view, the expectation set out in the Care Act that the person would have the best idea of what's important to them, and that you start from the point of finding out what that is. So you're trying to promote well-being. You want to know what that looks like for that person, and what that looks like for others around them and who else they want to involve in that, so that you get a sense of where you're trying to get to with your plan. And then how you go about it as well would be absolutely based on what the person could bring to the plan, and what their strengths might be and what their networks might be, their relationships might be. And actually, even if that you quite often get into a philosophical argument here about, well, what if the person wants something that isn't important? And that's almost like a non-question, because the thing that matters to them is the thing that matters to them. You can find that sometimes the thing that matters to someone is actually harmful to them or others. And then you're into a situation of saying, okay, well, what else, you know, what else might help you with that? Or, you know, what else might you be looking for? What might be deeper that might satisfy that need or that wish? or
but it's still not
we can't help you with it. Yeah, you can't dismiss that that's something that, and that will happen, you know, with parents as well, I guess. All those dilemmas around particular lifestyles, or particular behaviours, or particular relational strategies that, or outcomes that parents might want that actually aren't the best either for them or for their children.
Absolutely, and for the children as well. Many children, when you're working with them, particularly about where they might need to live in the future, the choices that they want to make are not always the choices that in professional or evidence-based opinions are the best thing for them, but it doesn't mean that it's not valid. I think it's about honouring the hopes and the desires of people, even if what we hope and desire for can't always be given to us. And I really, I like the solution-focused approach to finding out what matters to people. I think for me, trying to solve a problem and problem talk can drive us into places where everything looks hopeless or even to the wrong solutions. But if you're just curious about what a person's lived life would look like if the problem is gone, it can be really helpful. And the miracle question I use a lot, even on myself, actually, because it helps you imagine your future. If you say to someone, let's not worry about how it happened. Let's pretend that you went to sleep and when you woke up, your problem had disappeared. What would you notice that was different about your life? What's the first thing you would notice? And when people start to tell you what they'd notice, then you can say, well, who else would notice it? What would you do differently? What would you miss? And you can start to help them build a sense of what their day-to-day world would look like if that problem wasn't the focus of it, if it had been taken away. And when you hear that type of talk, it can be really helpful in planning because it can help you understand the steps they might need to take to get to that place that they value. You know, so yeah, I really like that approach for that.
That's really interesting. And actually, you made me think about coaching, but coaching almost, the coaching that I've done almost does take a slightly opposite approach in that you'd say what your goal is, and then you'd talk about the reality. And through talking about the reality, you tend to uncover options for how things could be different, because what people will say is, oh, it's like this and that's really tricky, and if only that wasn't there, or if only, you know, I would try and do this if these things weren't in place, or this person's quite helpful and I don't see them that much. So when you talk about how things are, you also uncover what people wish was different.
And I think all of this is wrapped up in this idea of future pull. You know, the work by Viktor Frankl, where he identified, you know, faith in a future as a key element in survival. And it's the idea that people have to believe that things can change for the better and that they can be part of that change. And I think with a lot of people that we work with, sometimes their change script in them, that they're stuck in a cycle of failure and of hopelessness, or, you know, here in Cumbria, they would say there's nout fresh in that lass, you know. So it's, if you're feeling that way, it's hard to plan for something different. And a critical step in good planning is creating confidence and self-belief. So we need to have a realistic picture of what life could be like as a good first step to understanding what someone wants for themselves.
Yes, and we might be, from what you've said, we might be one of the first people who've actually expressed a belief that that person could change. And one of the things I wanted to mention was, when we're thinking about outcomes or goals, some of those goals will be very much about changing things for the better, and some of them will be about keeping some things the same or trying to maintain things in the face of other change. So I'm just thinking about older people, for example. If you have a chronic health condition, your goal might not be, I'm going to absolutely improve my mobility. It might be to keep as mobile as you can. An element of just being really aware that in all of our lives, some things get better, some things get worse, some things stay the same. And we'd want to try and think holistically about that. And recognise the kind of pinch points as well, if it's harder at Christmas or it's harder in the school holidays, or actually we can be really positive about looking forward to spring. Those kind of cycle of goals as well.
At any time in a person's life, they will cope better or worse depending on their own circumstances and the context that they're in, and sometimes their age, the stage of life they're in.
Yeah, and there's a sense of planning, which is a really important element of planning, which is getting the time frame right and getting the review points right and the monitoring points right. And we won't, you know, we're going to talk about review separately in a later podcast, but that sense of the shape of the journey, you know, what stage are we at in it, and how much attention is needed right now, and how much change is there likely to be, and what kind of is the right time frame for this bit, you know, what goals need to happen really quickly and what things are longer term, because otherwise we can end up with a plan that's very narrow view of the person, just getting them out of hospital, or it's just overcoming a particularly kind of unsafe moment in their life, rather than thinking about where they might be. And one of the things as well that I find quite difficult is the cliff edge at 18, which I know is being changed a little bit, and people are moving to, a lot of teams are moving to planning up to 25 for young people.
For sure, yeah.
But I've talked to social workers who've said, you know, we've only got a couple of weeks to get things in place, because then this person's not going to be in our team anymore. And it's like, but they're going to be alive for hopefully another 70 or 80 years. And you're giving them 2 weeks. So there is something really problematic about some of our planning.
There is, and it's interesting. It always fascinates me, Jerry, because from the minute you receive a child into social care, and I'm not talking about bringing them into care, but the minute they're made known, we talk about the harm and danger to the child. I talk about all of this as managing the risk, repairing the child, and restoring the relationship and building resilience for the future. And it's this idea that we hear about, from the moment we hear about the child, the talk is all about the harm and danger, the things that have to be stopped or fixed. And it is critical that we're able to react as a service to prevent abuse and neglect to children as much as we possibly can. And so we're hardwired as an agency to plan to manage risk. And I feel like we're pretty good at the gotcha moment, you know, when everyone's in free fall and we catch them. But I think sometimes we don't attend to the emerging adult, because the child is always going to be 18. They're always going to turn into an adult, God willing. Everything about them is programmed for growth. So we need to do more than just manage risk. We need to repair the impact of the abuse and neglect. We need to build resilience, improve skills around relationship, knowledge, and self-care. All of that needs to be planned for. And then we need to find a way to restore the child's sense of self and identity. And for me, the important thing here, Jerry, is, sorry, I'm raving here, but this is one of my soapbox passionate things, is all children deserve a coherent public and private story to tell themselves and others about their life journey and about their encounters with social care. You know, every child who comes into contact with us should have a way of understanding and talking about their journey. And I think that planning for those three stages, yes, we've got a plan to manage the risk, but we must plan also to restore the child to a place where they have a really resilient sense of identity and a sense of self, and a good public story.
Yeah, and then they will be able to go on and have those successful relationships in the future. And it's interesting, if you think about your plan always as a bit of the story, it would hopefully be really clear in the plan that at this point in time, these were the things that were going on, and this is what we were most engaged with. And we also had an eye to the future. Yeah. And you've actually made me think quite a lot. It's almost exactly the opposite kind of thing, but end of life planning. You know, when you work with an older adult or with somebody who's got a life limiting condition, you would be thinking about not just what's immediately going on right now and what will be happening in the kind of short to medium term, but actually, have you ever had the chance to think about how you want the rest of your life to play out? What journey do you want up to the end? What kind of an ending do you want? And starting to have those conversations with people is really important. And there's some tools that I've seen for end of life care, which are around, they're not trying to put timeframes on things, but they're saying right now, in the near future, in a bit, you know, later on, so that you can actually have the conversation without being being too prescriptive about it. But certainly for a kid to be talking about what kind of adult they want to be, that seems like a fine conversation to have.
I think both conversations are fine. We should, as much as possible, when people feel overwhelmed or distressed or out of control or they're in difficult spaces, good planning is containing, and good planning allows you to feel like you've got a direction to go in or a purpose or a way to handle something that's particularly difficult or frightening.
And I think talking openly about this being a part of a person's life, my intervention as a social worker, I'm here right now because these things are going on, but I do want to understand how that fits with your life story and where you're going next and what's going to happen beyond here. And also planning for the end of the intervention, so that we are always thinking about that kind of end of our encounter and the contingency planning beyond that. So a really good plan will have the immediate, the kind of things that we're working towards, and then what will happen when we've stopped working with someone, and, you know, what if things suddenly change?
But that's the other thing, isn't it? Because none of us will only have one crisis in our life, and we won't know what those things look like. And so the people we're working with are bound to have in their life's journey other difficult times. And some of the planning we need to do is about skill transference. So helping people know how to plan well for those difficult times, and helping build resilience and those types of skills that you need to keep kind of going around while things are buffeting you everywhere, I think is really important too. So reminding, and that's why planning and partnership is so important, because you're transferring skills at the same time, and you're reminding families that they can manage.
And now might not be the right time for them to engage with a particular challenge in their life, and we might then have moved on. But if we've given them some ideas about how they might approach that, then the next time they might be able to.
Yep. Or they might get help quicker, or they might know what kind of help they need more quickly, you know, because there's nothing wrong with going back to a resource either. There's nothing wrong with planning to return to something. You want to feel effective in your own life, don't you? And we're wanting to help people plan to feel effective in their own life. You know, if adults are caught in powerful systems like poverty or poor housing, dangerous communities, they might not feel like they have a lot of control over changing their circumstances. We really have to understand when we're making plans what people's context is and what their capacity is. And I think the other thing, you know, in children's services is that contextual safeguarding is a concept that's just been introduced into Working Together, the 2018 version. And it's good because it talks about, as well as threats to welfare of children from within their families, children may be vulnerable to abuse or exploitation from outside their families. And it highlights that actually sometimes the adults, their parents, people who are caring for them, actually don't know how to manage those threats, exploitation by criminal gangs, county lines, trafficking, online abuse, those types of things. And it may be that adults in that environment are feeling very powerless. It's a really big piece of work, planning. And yet I often see people, because of the types of forms we use, and we talked about this ourselves, we talked about assessment before we talked about planning, that at the end of the assessment, they kind of push the plan out at the last minute because they've used all their time on the assessment, and they end up doing the plan kind of at their desk quite rapidly, and then they take it to the family. Whereas, of course, in an ideal world, what they would have done was sat down with the family and actually drawn up that plan together, and then just transferred those words back into the machine, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so the plan is owned by the people that it's about. And that's really clear as well. It's really clearly their language, makes sense to them what they're trying to achieve. And also it has these really clear steps in it, so you can see how you're doing. And you need something, we all need something quite quickly that we feel like we've achieved. When I do a to-do list, I usually write do a to-do list at the top of it so I can tick it off straight away. But having that kind of sense of achievement is going to be really important, isn't it?
Yeah. So not making them too complex, too out of reach, which is where I think the miracle question comes in again, because it grounds you back into, well, what would you have to do today for things to be better? And science of safety as well, actually, is very focused.
And having those time frames on
it. Change.
Yeah. Right now, today, next week, by this date, who's going to do it? How are we going to do it? Yeah, that's the smart stuff, isn't it? It's the making sure we can actually see the progress we're making.
Yes. Well, that's right. That's the other thing, isn't it? Plans have to have an outcome. And one of the most important things about a plan is its implementation. Is not just what you write, it's about what you do, and it's about the steps you enable everyone to take. And if you don't ever put a plan into practice, then it's not going to be anything, is it? It's just not going to be helpful at all.
And if we're thinking about kind of the really complex environments, there may not be a clear road. What you might need is a plan that says, we're going to try this for a bit and see how it goes. And if it doesn't work, we'll try something else. But you'd still need an outcome that you're aiming for and a way of measuring against that. But it might be that you try something for a while and it's not the thing that helps that person feel that their relationships have improved, or helps the person make connections in their community or improve their health or keep safe or get their kids to school. You might have to come back on yourself and try off again, go off again.
Yeah, and I think that's important too, isn't it? Because for a lot of people, we don't get to change the plan as often as we could. And it's about, if we're adjusting it as we're working with people, where are we capturing that so we can all understand where it's going? And that moves us into recording, which I know we're going to probably do something on at some stage.
Yeah. review would be a good time to talk about that, actually, because it's quite often a new person who reviews. I mean, the other thing here is, of course, we're talking about the best kind of planning, and in real life you do the best you can within a context. So a lot of adult workers will see somebody once and be trying to put a plan together with, trying to understand the situation, put a plan together with them, and then send it out afterwards. Or you might be seeing someone in hospital and they're medically fit for discharge, they have to be home in 2 days. Or you've just got a case and you're nearly at the end of the assessment time for a kid and you've got to rush out. And yeah, so in those cases, I think going back to what you said in the assessment about being really clear about how much awareness you had, how long you had, what you thought were the most important things and what you might need to come back to in the plan. Because I think it's fine to say in the plan, there's this other set of stuff that we need to work on and we don't quite have outcomes and actions for it yet, but the next person might want to pick it up.
These are the things that I've been able to address in this time with the person. Boom, boom, boom. These are the things that are probably still outstanding, or even putting a time limit on the plan. This plan that I've done in 1 hour should be good, should serve this person for this many weeks, this many days, or for this purpose.
And if you see the plan as like a signpost along the route of someone's life, it's really helpful to say where they are, you know, which crossroads they happen to be at that point and which direction they're taking off from it. And then the next person, you know, they themselves will have a sense of where that plan's come from and where it's going. But then also the next person that they work with will be able to see which bit of the journey it related to.
Now, do we have any good tools that we like, Jerry?
I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but I love Important 2, Important 4. Which is a really simple person-centered tool where you have two columns and you write down, I, Jerry, what's important to me is going to the pub and going out on my bike and, you know, seeing my friends. And what's important for me is probably not crashing my bike and probably not spending too long in the pub and, you know, doing whatever it is that I need to maintain my health and earning some money, those kind of things. And sometimes you have the same things on both sides and sometimes you don't. And sometimes there's a real clash as well.
Yes, I suspect mine would be quite different, I'm afraid. Yeah.
And also, if you involve different people about, you know, what does my husband think is important to and important for Jerry, you get different ideas. And the social worker obviously can then be, you know, do it themselves and can say, well, I'm hearing it's important to you about this, but I'm going to be really honest with you that it's important for public services that you're not calling an ambulance every day. What can we do? So that I find that really useful to kind of separate that out.
I like that. I like and the tool I like is a little bit similar, actually, because I like the pros and cons of change. That idea that before you embark off on any great plan, that you completely and utterly understand what you'll gain and what you'll lose from what you're about to do. So it's a very simple matrix, and at the top it just says, what will I gain? What will others gain? What will I lose? And what will others lose? Because one of the things, of course, that we know is that any change that you make, which is usually, I mean, planning is nearly always about planning to do something differently. And in that doing something differently, you gain things, but you also lose things. And it's that loss that sometimes gets in the way of you carrying out the plan.
Right.
And so if you understand what will be the why you wanted that and what you'll miss and how difficult it would be, you can actually plan for what you're going to do when that sandbag hits.
And this is why the other thing that's really useful is the thing that all children are brilliant at, which is the why question. We're going to do this. Why? Here's an outcome. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it gets you ultimately to the root of it. So I'm going to refer you, I put on the plan, an outcome is to refer to so-and-so. That's not an outcome. Why are we doing that? Oh, it's so that they can do this. Why would they do that? So that this can happen. Why is that important? Well, because actually that will help this person have more links in the community. Why does that matter? You keep going until you eventually get to the point where you're actually saying how the person's life will be better. And the other thing that's good with that is if somebody says, I really want to hang out with these guys. They're my friends, and you know that there's harm there. So it's kind of important to important for issue. Why is it important to you? You're really getting at the heart of that, because you may find that the motivation, the desire can be met in some other way. So really asking why all the time. why do you want that?
Why
are we doing this? The so what question.
Do we feel like we've talked ourselves to a standstill?
Yes, I think probably the reflective point, it's not a question actually, but there's this quote that I found, which is, a goal without a plan is just a wish. So I think the reflective points for us and for people that we're working with is, first of all, what do we wish for? And then, okay, so what are we going to do about it? What's our plan?